Hello and welcome to this special edition of the Saxo Market Call podcast. It is Wednesday, 24th of November, 2021, as we are recording this. Welcoming today, Brent Donnelly of SpectrumMarkets.com. A wonderful opportunity to have you on the show, Brent. You're a veteran trader, especially in FX, so currencies. You've worked with major banks at least a couple of hedge funds. Author of two books, so we're going to get into that later. But first of all, welcome to the show.
Hey, John. Thanks. Thanks a lot for having me.
All right. Now, just for briefly, for users, maybe listeners would be a better word out there. Give us an impression of your background and your impressive resume, where you're coming from. And we'll talk, of course, about SpectrumMarkets.com and your books. But just so we know who you are.
Sure. So I started at Citibank in 1995 on the spot desk in foreign exchange. And now that was a very different time in foreign exchange than if you want, we can talk about that. So I've been trading pretty much nonstop since 1995, but there's been some different things that I did in between. So the majority of my career has been as a market maker in spot in G10 foreign exchange. But then for 5 years, I traded my own money during the NASDAQ bubble from 98 to 03. So that was a very different experience. And then I also worked at a hedge fund in Connecticut for a while after the crisis because I had worked at Lehman Brothers until the end. So when Lehman went under, I went to work at a hedge fund, which was an interesting and different experience as well from being a market maker. And then kind of running in the background the whole time has been, I've always been interested in writing and in creative pursuits. So for example, I had a TV show, a cartoon that was on TV in Canada for a short bit, basically one season. And I do a lot of writing on the side. And then I think that comes out in what I do. So I write a daily called AMFX, which used to always just go to clients, institutional investors and all that. But now that I'm at Spectra, I've gone to a different paid model so anyone can subscribe. And then, like you said, I have the books. So my kind of passions have always been like math and puzzle solving and writing. So obviously the math and puzzle solving comes out in the trading, and then the writing, I've found a way to kind of like hopefully write in a non-boring way about finance. That's kind of like my goal.
Well, from my point of view, you certainly succeed in that. And I would definitely say that that comes through your focus on writing and your focus on trying to communicate what you're saying in writing is very successful. You write with a lot of energy, I find enthusiasm, conviction, at the same time, a wonderful sense of, I think, humility. You can often sound very convicting and really, sell the idea that you've delved into, but you also say, look, this is a tough business. This is a tough game. And the win-loss percentage isn't what it's about. It's just about being, when you're right, you're right big. And when you're wrong small, and you know your risk going in.
Yeah. One interesting thing about that too, is that as you get more experience, and especially if you collect statistics on your trading, which I do, you start to have a good understanding of, of what your win-loss ratio is or what your statistics are. And then it doesn't hurt as much when you're wrong, because you're like, okay, well, historically I'm wrong 50% of the time. So it's, that those days when you're wrong, you can just chalk it up to that's variance. And if you're making two and you're losing one and you're right 50% of the time, that's going to be a pretty good trading career. So I've found it easier to not embrace the wrongness. Like obviously you want to be correct and you want to forecast the market well and trade well. But I think once you have a good understanding of what your statistical profile looks like, it gets easier to accept that, I'm wrong. I was wrong on RBNZ this week, and it's not like, I don't really feel very emotional about it anymore. It's more just like, okay, well, you have all the information, you try to make your best forecast or your best trade. And then if you're right, great. If you're wrong, not as great. And you move on and you focus on the process of trade idea development and risk management a lot more than the outcome of like, how much money did I make on the trade?
Yeah. And I can't underline how, what a healthy perspective that is to have on markets and a rarity, because there are too many out there that try to, offer the impression that there's some high ability to, or some ability to maintain a high winning percentage or have the sure thing or whatever. So, kudos for the honesty on, you know, on that front. All right, let's talk a little bit about your first book that you wrote back in 2019, or at least it's the first book I'm aware you've written.
No, that's right.
Yes, The Art of Currency Trading. And what a wonderful title. It's not too often you go to Wiley, you know, which writes a huge publishing company. They have a jillion books on trading and all kinds of things finance related, with the title The Art of Currency Trading. So why the art and not the science or the mathematics or the fundamentals of currency trading?
Sure. So it kind of goes to my philosophy, I think, which relates to my philosophy on life as well, which is that a broad approach with a lot of inputs gives you the best outcome or helps you make the best decisions. So, you know, some people focus very much on technical analysis, or some people focus exclusively on macro fundamentals or like a specific methodology. And I think part of the reason that I've survived so long is that I'm not married to one methodology. So I'm more married to the idea of like, how can I make money and what's going to work in this regime? And so if you are, let's say you are a breakout trader and that's your thing, well, when volatility is low, you're not going to make money almost by definition. And so the art is pulling together a lot of different methodologies and then finding a way to then adapt in real time so that you're not using the same methodology all the time. So, you know, for example, like I do a lot of correlation trading. So you look at, you know, the assets that are related to the currency that you trade, and then you try to get clues from those assets where your currency is going to go. So a simple example would be iron ore and copper are major exports of Australia. So if you see the spot market or the futures market for those two commodities starting to rally intraday and the Australian dollar hasn't moved, then all other things being equal, you would guess that Aussie has a greater chance of going up. Now, you can turn that into a systematic strategy, but the problem with that is that sometimes those correlations just don't matter because there's, you know, 14 other things going on. If the Fed is, you know, sending a message that they're going to hike 50 basis points, then that's probably more important to Aussie than the price of iron ore going up, you know, 28 basis points. So to me, the idea is to have a very strong radar for a lot of different inputs. And so looking at correlation, technical analysis, fundamental analysis, positioning, and other inputs. But then the art part is toggling between the inputs so that you're focused on the right thing. Because like, for example, one of the things I listed there is positioning. And sometimes people just obsess over positioning all the time. And my observation would be that 80 to 90% of the time, positioning is irrelevant. There's just other factors that are driving the market. And at the extremes, then positioning can be the single variable that matters. But then all those in between the extremes, normally positioning is not important. So I think there's definitely a lot of obviously mathematical and sort of like more scientific aspects to trading. But then as a discretionary trader, which is what I am, I think my skill has been to adapt over time and identify different regimes and different inputs that matter, and understand what matters when.
I think you just unpacked so many things, and actually, almost like you're sitting here reading some of my notes, ticking off the various areas that you use as inputs. And actually, apropos to your Aussie doll example, wonderful example in the use of correlations. I built a couple of models back in the day, looking at those types of correlations of where Aussie ought to be trading or Aussie dollar ought to be trading relative to those types of things. And you have these very confusing situations, as you mentioned, where something like iron ore or BHP equity stock, for example, which is a good proxy for iron ore in some cases, is doing swimmingly. And then you have the case in 2018 when that's going well for you. But then if you're interested in buying Aussie, but on the other side, the Australian yields are collapsing relative to US yields and are actually a predominant theme. So just, you know, and like you said, if the Fed is hiking, that might be a more important factor. So it's knowing when to switch and knowing when those divergences diverge, when you should notice the divergence, say maybe something else is up, or whether it's an opportunity to see something that divergence being an opportunity to actually close the gap and have some kind of arbitrage trade.
Right. And that really comes down to, I think this is an important thing for investors and for traders, is it comes down to having a framework that actually works. So for example, a lot of people think that higher rates are bad for the stock market. And empirically, that's just not true. There's a point where tightening does impact the stock market once, you know, the yield curve goes inverted or various ways you can measure, you know, are financial conditions tight. But historically, higher rates don't necessarily mean, they can mean, but they don't necessarily mean lower stocks. Or like right now, people are struggling to find the right framework for yields because yields seem very low relative to what any logic would probably say. And I remember one time in 2010 where most people were still very bearish stocks. And again, like a lot of people have been bearish stocks the whole way up because they just had the wrong framework. So I remember seeing David Tepper on CNBC and he was literally, I mean, he's a very straight talker. And he was like, listen, dudes, there's a lot of liquidity. Liquidity is plentiful and it's going to get more plentiful. Stocks are going to go up. I'm long. And that was his analysis. Like sometimes it doesn't have to be all that complicated. It's not always that simple either. But it really does come down to like having the right framework and understanding what matters. You get that a lot as well when the economy is weakening and that is leading to greater expectation of central bank easing.
Yes.
So weak data means stocks go up and that makes people really angry sometimes. So yeah, a lot of what I'm trying to do all the time is understand what framework's working and what is not, and then also trying to look forward, not backward, because obviously it's easy to backtest things and fit them and model them. But the issue with all that backward looking stuff is that the markets are just so incredibly dynamic that by the time you finish your backtesting, some other new regime is starting or new framework is in place.
Yeah, and if I recall at the time, there was even a moniker for that David Tepper type of approach, which is the Tepper trade. At least I don't think I was the only one using that analysis. Yeah. And it was true because you would actually have that crazy logic going on. It seemed crazy, but it makes sense from what he says. Look, if things are improving, stocks will go up. If things aren't improving, stocks will go up because the Fed will ease until things improve. So
right.
It was like, you know, heads the market wins, tails the market wins even more.
Yeah. And you see it as well with individual stocks, like people trying to use discounted cash flow to value Tesla in a raging momentum fueled market just makes no sense. Like, sure, if you want to be bearish Tesla, find some kind of momentum based, you know, moving average crossover strategy or something, but being bearish Tesla because of valuation is a classic example of just a wrong framework, in my opinion. And that doesn't mean I'm bullish Tesla, by the way.
Well, specific to Tesla, there was a recent article, and it's something we actually talked a lot about in the podcast, just the degree to which it's become its own thing. And there was a very well laid out argument on how it's become this crazy phenomenon because there's an options tail that is wagging the entire Tesla share market dog, if you will, and in some cases even the whole entire market. It seems that more broadly speaking, staggering volumes of options going through, and then all the market makers that have to delta hedge those options by buying the underlying, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a mad phenomenon that has, you know, completely separated from fundamentals. And like you say, that's not because you can be bullish or bearish Tesla necessarily. You just have to trade Tesla for what it is.
Exactly.
Not on those fundamental dividend future
dividend models. Yeah, trade the market that is, not the market that you wish. There's some kind of cliche that's similar to that. I think there's another aphorism or cliche that's like, do you want to be smart or do you want to make money? And, you know, the goal should be to make money and invest in or trade in ways that make money.
Right. And then I really like what you say on positioning too. And I heartily agree. And I've noted as well, sometimes the best positioning the way to approach positioning is just to have it sort of tucked in the back of your mind that when there's a piece of news item or something that hits one of the important fundamental spots of the currency you're focusing on in the wrong way or not according to whatever the predominant market narrative is, you can realize how suddenly important that might be because like you, I think you specifically say in the book, it's sort of like fuel, potential fuel for a trade. It's sort of like, a forest fire has a lot of potential fuel. If there hasn't been one around for a long time, there's lots of dead wood. Well, positioning is like that dead wood suddenly becomes very activated if suddenly the market is hit with the wrong type of information.
Yeah, exactly. And the issue with, so I learned this the hard way because I was one of those people that wants to be smart all the time and wants to be smarter than everyone. So I used to be contrarian all the time when I started trading. And the reality is that the herd makes money a lot of the time because the strongest trends, almost all the positioning is always the same direction as the price. So if price has been going up for a while, the market's going to be long. And so if in a world where things are trending, which is very often the case, and actually usually the easiest way to make money is, you know, participating in trends. If you're compulsively contrarian, then you're just going to have a really hard time trading. So ideally what you have to be is just an independent thinker. You know, you're willing to say, okay, yeah, this is a bull market and I'm going to be long and I don't care if everyone else is long. And then you're also willing to say, you know, I know everyone's long and everyone's telling me how great this Web3 is going to be, but to me, it feels like a hype machine, you know, at the wrong moment in the cycle. So I'm going to go short crypto or whatever. You know, I'm just picking examples, but I think you have to have the intellectual flexibility to both go with the herd or go with the trend and also to go against it and not be biased to what, I mean, everyone has a slight bias one way or the other to be a mean reversion or a trend person. But if you're a really good trader, you are not biased one way or the other. You'll ride the trends and then you'll play the counter moves and play mean reversion as well.
Yes. And so in case, in case you're not getting a sense of it from our discussion here, I think you have a very healthy point that you make in the art of currency trading. And that is, this is not an easy game. There are a lot of things to keep track of. There are a lot of things to consider. And we've just mentioned a lot of market sort of market centered bits and pieces that you need to keep track of and be on top of to be able to trade effectively. But you also emphasize a lot of other things that I think are very interesting. The character of the trader, him or herself, which you get into even, I think, more deeply in your second book, and we'll get to that in a moment. But also, I think there's some really intriguing ways that you approach money management. And this is not just basic approaches like, look, you have to have a stop and you should have a set size, a loss size as a percentage of the portfolio going to the trade, not a set trading amount. Those basic things, you know, that's pretty widespread knowledge. But this concept of expected value, I like the way you approach that and how it can allow you to vary your bet size based on what you're perceiving as a probability of a given trade. Can you take us through just sort of conceptually how you use expected value for trade sizing and just for the sort of the approach going into a trade?
Sure. So there's definitely some debate around whether ex ante conviction or your conviction on a trade beforehand correlates to the probability of success of that trade. I think in general, you sometimes have a sense, but for me, what I believe mostly is that there's a whole, I'm a relatively short-term trader, so I do a lot of trades in a year. And there's a huge list of trades that are all kind of in one bucket. And then there's probably like three or four other trades that are you recognize beforehand are like, wow, this is a huge trade. Like June FOMC, I felt really strongly that it was going to be hawkish and everyone was short dollars and almost everyone was not positioned for it. So I had a really strong feeling, okay, this is like a five-star super high conviction trade. And I think you can recognize that beforehand, especially with experience. And then you can kind of look at, and then something that I really emphasize too is that what you want to do with your risk and your position sizing is try to behave like a call option, which means essentially if you have a bad month or a bad year, you'll be down a bit. So that would be like buying an option. You know, you're going to lose a little bit of money if you have a terrible year. But if you have a great year, you're going to make 7x what you would have lost in a bad year or month or however you want to look at it. And the way that you can do that is mathematically increasing your position size as you're more profitable in proportion to your aggregate amount of capital. And then on the expected value side, I mean, essentially, I feel like what one mistake that a lot of people make is, and I publish my trade ideas. So people say like, oh, you're risking 50 pips to make 50. That doesn't seem like very good risk yes. reward. But it's a three-dimensional question. So the risk reward is how much am I risking in terms of, I'll just say pips, but basis points, percent, whatever, or dollars in a stock or whatever. So let's just say in a stock, because it's just the easiest to explain and understand. So if I'm buying the stock at 100 and my stop loss is 95 and my take profit's 105, people will say, well, that doesn't seem like very good risk reward. But I might think ex ante that there's like a 75% chance that 105 is going to trade before 95. So then all of a sudden you look at that and it's like, wow, that's an amazing trade. So I think people tend to look at it in two dimensions, but there's a third dimension, which is what probability do you assign to the two outcomes? And I think I find, for whatever reason, I think it's because there's sort of like this cliche that you got to structure everything that's so that it pays 3-to-1. And I don't believe that at all. I do lots of trades where I'm risking 50 to make 50, because it might be such a good setup that I have like 6 reasons to be bullish. And I know that I can take a really big position and automate my stop. And I know exactly where I'm going to stop out. And those can be really amazing trades. And if you're trading a short enough time horizon, I feel like those present as often as the, or more often than the, a really good 3-to-1. And then, you know, sometimes you can get 10-to-1 if you have an option and you have a strong view and it's a 2-week view. But I feel like you need to always kind of be looking at those different, like the different inputs into expected value. And one thing that I mean, you witness this all the time, but it's empirically true too, is that human beings prefer long shots. So when you go to the horse races, you don't bet on the like risk 10 to make $1 horse, even if that horse is like 99.999% chance to win, because it's boring, right? And the optics aren't very fun. And people, a lot of people are often trading, whether they admit it or not, are trading to some extent for fun and stimulation. And so I think part of that is why people tend to go, you know, it's the cool way to say it, if you're a hedge fund manager, is like, I'm placing asymmetrical bets, or I'm establishing trades with strong asymmetrical risk return ratios and stuff like that. But what you're really doing a lot of times is just buying lottery tickets. So like if something pays 8-to-1 and then there's a very good chance that the real odds of that thing actually happening are 10-to-1. So I try to stay grounded in like, this isn't like going to play blackjack or poker where the probabilities are known in advance. You're estimating the probabilities, and that's one of many, many things that makes trading harder than just straight up gambling. Conceptually, it's just a lot more complicated. But I try to go in with the idea that, in general, long shots always look more attractive. And so you want to try to stay away from them, or at least fully understand with eyes wide open what you're doing when you buy an option that pays 10-to-1. Are the odds actually that good, or are the real odds not that good, but you're just thinking, man, if I hit this thing, I'm going to kick ass this month. And that's a bad approach.
Yeah. And by the way, and of course you know this, but you encourage journaling. And so all of these things about, rating the probability of a trade, whether it's a 5-star trade, as you call it, and your level of conviction and your expected value, those, you can test how good you are at that process. If you've done 100 trades, you review, say, well, actually my conviction ratings are crap, or I need to work on that, or whatever. So,
right. And that's a very interesting approach. Information, right? Cause you, as a trader that doesn't collect data, you could be sitting there going like, oh, I know for sure this one's going to work. And then you start thinking, oh, but the ones I know for sure, they don't actually work. And you can start going in these crazy loops in your head. Whereas just if you keep track of all your trades, or at least your daily statistics, then you start to collect all this useful data, and then you start to have a really good understanding of your own trading. And then you can say, okay, I know my high convictions, like I'm right 58% of the time, and my average trade is 51%. So it makes sense to allocate 1.5x to my higher conviction trades. Or maybe it's vice versa. And it's like, there's like some people believe that there's a point on the curve where you become overconfident. So like, if you think, oh, I'm going to put my entire net worth into this trade, that potentially could be a red flag at some point where you're overconfident. But what you can do, yeah, is record your confidence level before you do the trade or when you do the trade. And then you can start to match it up and you can say, okay, well, there's no correlation or there's a strong correlation or it's inverse or whatever. And like I said, at the top of the show, to me, collecting my data and knowing that I make money on average 50% of the time, and I've been collecting my data since 2006, has really made it a little bit less of a roller coaster emotionally for me when I lose money. So like, say I lose money 4 days in a row, well, run a simulation of coin tosses and you'll see a lot of four heads in a row, right? So it's not very alarming if you lose money 4 days in a row, if you understand that you were following your process and, you know, things just didn't work out. That's variance. And it's really hard to distinguish between variance and bad trading if you don't have any data, because you just don't know what is normal and what's not in the distribution of your P&L.
Yeah, and you can also do things like, say, test whether your conviction or your ability or a willingness to allow a trade to run a little bit more should be there or not, by saying, well, what could I have achieved above my target for these last 100 trades if I'd been a bit more patient? So in other words, it's behaviorally, if you're chopping off your profits too early relative to your losses. But I have to say, Art of Currency Trading, I'll put the link in there, definitely in the show notes. And there's just, I mean, this is standing on the shoulder of a giant. Obviously, from our talk here, somebody who has extensive experience of trading and trading FX. And at the back, there's some wonderful rules that you go through, rules of FX trading, from number one, don't blow up, to some other wonderful ones. There's one I wanted to get to here. The last one, of course, have fun. If you don't enjoy it, what's the point? And then there's another one I have that I love, is number eight, FX trading, it doesn't always have to make sense. What do you mean? What do you mean by that one?
that's kind of going back to the framework thing, right? Like you can argue that like stocks going up doesn't make sense. I mean, I know I'm agnostic on stocks. I don't really care whether they go up or down, but I know a lot of people feel that it makes no sense that they're going up, or like, you know, the thing we said where bad economic data stocks go up. It just doesn't always have to make sense in the logical way that you think it should make sense. And actually the risk of ruin, people getting ruined, is very often that's what, you know, like GameStop or whatever. I mean, that's a very, very extreme example, but there's many examples even in macro and stuff where it's just like the move just didn't make sense. Like the bond rally in the summer, right? That killed people. And yeah, it just, you know, sometimes things just happen that don't make sense. And that's why I think risk management is just so absolutely important. And that's why I say number one is manage risk of ruin. Like, don't trade pegged currencies. Don't trade things that you can't stop out. Don't take weekend positions if it's going to jeopardize 60% of your capital. If an M&A headline, don't be short a stock that could be an M&A target over the weekend. I mean, some of these things are knowable and some aren't, but many of the problems that people get into, like October, the rates blow up. I mean, millions of these things, the SMB in 2015, they're things that you knew in advance could potentially be a tail risk. And so number one is always avoid risk of ruin. And I think that's a really funny, it's not really funny, but funny, ironic aspect of the book, Reminiscences of a Stock Operator. It's an amazing
classic.
It's an unbelievable book. It's just like the writing and the storytelling.
Can I break in there? Just once, in case users don't or listeners don't know, Reminiscences of a Stock Operator is such a brilliant book because it's written by somebody that's a writer that just has some incredible close knowledge of the actual subject of the book, who's Jesse Livermore, a very famous, I would argue, is a genius on some levels, a polymath, a genius observer of markets, and a very successful trader who made and lost fortunes multiple times, from nothing to being extremely rich and influential. All-time classic, written in 1923 as if it's a fictional character, but it's actually about Jesse Livermore. But sorry to interrupt there. I just wanted to make sure.
No, no problem. I mean, yeah. It's an incredible book, and it's actually part of a package of things that got me into trading. And the irony, or the funny but not funny haha part, is that it's really a cautionary tale, right? Because he went bankrupt so many times, and his life kind of ended in an extremely tragic way. And so the fun and excitement and all that you get out of that book can also kind of be the downfall of a trader. And so I think it's a really interesting aspect that his life overall is kind of a cautionary tale for traders. But yet, you know, it's sort of like the best and the worst of trading, which is trading for excitement and all that eventually will lead to ruin. But at the same time, it shouldn't be this horrible grind. Like when I was day trading, that was one of the most fun times I ever traded in the late 90s, the tech bubble. And I worked on the trading floor where you rent your seat. So it's kind of like what people would call a bucket shop in this day, but it wasn't. It was a professional place with all, you know, semi-professional people. And they had a huge banner on the wall that said, "Thank God it's Monday." And it would, you know, when trading's going well, that's what it feels like. You know, you come in on Monday and you can't wait for the market to open. Or for me, it's Sunday because that's when currencies open. You know, I love flipping open my, even after all these years, I love flipping open Bloomberg to see where, you know, see if there's any gaps on Sunday and see if there's anything to trade. So I think there's an element of, it has to be fun, but not too fun. And a lot of the stuff with trading really is like that in terms of a spectrum, right? And that kind of also relates to the risk seeking versus risk averse spectrum, is that if you're too risk averse, you can't really be a good trader. But if you're too risk seeking, you can. I mean, on any part of the spectrum, you can succeed, but ideally there's like an ideal point on the spectrum. And I think that kind of mirrors the investing and trading as a fun, it should be a fun puzzle solving math exercise that is stimulating and enjoyable. But the primary goal that you're seeking has to be profit, not fun, because a lot of trading for fun looks very much like gambling and has many of the same features as gambling.
Yeah, well, you've just provided me with a great segue to your second book. And that is actually rule number 17. Of the FX trader, which is, you know, you can control the process, but you cannot control the outcome. And I think that's so important for any trader, is to invest their ego in a process and not in the outcome itself as a rating on what they did right or wrong. Of course, over time, the P&L has to take care of itself for the process to become successful. And the reason I use that as a segue is because in your second book, which is just out a few months ago, it's even longer. So congratulations on that.
Don't panic. There's 100 pages of charts.
Over 500 pages of that, and talking about process and not the outcome. You really spend considerable time. I've not gone all the way through this one. I did read cover to cover The Art of Currency Trading. But if we look at just how you've divided up the book, some of the main titles, and if you look at the subtitle of the book, Alpha Trader, The Mindset, Methodology, and Mathematics of Professional Trading, I think that mindset bit is really interesting. And you're putting in tremendous amount of space there on mindset. So what do you need to do to trade successfully? And you were just talking about risk willingness versus being risk averse and dealing with that. So what was your focus in this book, and why did you spend so much time on that part of this whole process?
Well, so one cool thing that came out of when I sent the book to a few early readers, to like Ben Hunt wrote the foreword, who's somebody that I respect a lot, and a couple of friends. And the feedback that they gave me was, oh, this is cool. I'm going to send it to like my niece who's not in trading, or like my uncle or whatever, because there's a lot of stuff about decision-making and self-awareness and process versus outcome, which you mentioned. A lot of sort of things that are obviously very strongly related to trading, but also are important just in life in general. And so I appreciated that comment, because that's kind of like, I guess, by accident, what I was ended up doing was in many parts kind of tying it to how you make decisions in life. Or, you know, for example, like I'm starting this new business because my daily note that I used to send out was always free and it only went to institutionals. And now I'm doing it as a subscription-based service. And so instead of focusing on like, okay, how many subscribers do I have today? You know, did I get three more? Did I get two more? I try to focus on writing a good note and, you know, making sure that people know about it by going on Twitter or whatever. And that's the process. And then the outcome just has to take care of itself. And I think the bad approach is to be sitting there watching my inbox and waiting for the new subscribers. And so like, I feel like this kind of applies in, it's kind of a cliche. Like if you Google process outcome PGA or Major League Baseball or whatever, you know, it's a thing that a lot of people talk about, but honestly, I think it's so valid. And even if it's a bit of a cliche, I think understanding it conceptually and actually living it and doing it are two different things anyways. So I really think it's something that's really useful for me. And also going back to like the variance versus versus drawdown stuff. And then also kind of thinking about having fun or not having fun. If you are just have a really strong process and say like, okay, I'm going to read all the central bank speeches. I'm going to look at all the correlated markets, do my technical analysis, whatever, all these things. Cause like a guy that I used to work with, his big emphasis was just do the work, do the work, do the work. And that's kind of similar. You know, if you're lazy and you don't really do what you're supposed to do and then you lose money, that's to me is if I'm doing that, that's a lot more disappointing than like I come in at 6:30, do the work, have a really strong idea, you know, that has six reasons behind it. And then I lose money on that idea. I almost don't even care because I know I followed my process. I made a good decision. And, you know, there's good decision, bad outcome is a thing, right? So like if something's 90% likely to happen and it pays 10-1, you should be taking that bet all day. And if you lose, it's kind of like poker. Like if you have a pair of aces and dude has a pair of sixes and you go all in and he goes all in and you lose, you need to have the mindset to know that that's just bad luck and you made a good decision. And so honestly, you should just laugh and move on and focus on the next hand. And in trading, it's the same thing. It's just endless series of absorbing all the information, making a good decision with the information that you have, which is always totally, you know, crazy incomplete. So you're working with a lot of incomplete information and a very complex system. You're taking all the inputs and all the variables, you're making your decision, and then the outcome just pops out of there. And honestly, if you're in a good mindset, you should almost barely care about the outcome. Like obviously you care because the accumulation of all those outcomes is your performance. However, that's really not the point of good trading, in my opinion. The point of good trading is understanding what your edge is, having a process, and executing in a way that's with a really rigorous risk management system. And then just that's the machine. And then the widgets pop out of the edge of the machine, and some of those widgets are going to be defective, but that doesn't mean the machine was bad.
Yeah. And I have to say, I love, anecdote you have, a war story, if you will. I think you must have had it in both books, because I noticed you had it at the end of you call it the coda at the end of The Art of Trading, where you talk about a single day, a very remarkable day in 2010, when we had in May, I believe it was, when you had the flash crash in the U.S. equity market. And you were sitting there with dollar yen and trading some very large dollar yen positions. And I can't remember if you put it in that context, but also saying, you know, why smart people do stupid things. And it's just a hilarious anecdote. Why, you know, even somebody like you, a very experienced trader that knows all the right things to do, both does a lot of right stuff throughout that day, which had many ups and many downs, the roller coaster day, to say the least. But luckily you got it right in the end. But it was like the entire, you know, universe of potential bad and good behaviors was almost contained within that microcosm of a day.
Well, you know, that's what's crazy about it is like I started in 1995, so whatever that is, 26 years, and I can still sometimes, obviously, or maybe not obviously, but maybe people won't believe this who just started trading, but 26 years later, I still make some of those rookie mistakes. And it's part of it is because like you're in the zone, and a lot of it is system one thinking. You don't have time to like sit there and contemplate. So you're doing a lot of stupid things. So, but the interesting thing that I've noticed as I got more experienced was almost like this out of body experience. Like that's a little strong, but enough self-awareness to see that I'm doing the stupid thing and then course correct. And I've actually even sat next to someone like, and said, you know what, I'm bullish and I'm short right now. And I have no idea how I got short, but I'm bullish. And then that kind of self-awareness, I probably wouldn't have had 15 years ago. I would have justified the short position somehow and said like, oh, you know, yeah, actually the price action, this and that, it looks heavy or whatever. So now I think the second level that I achieved at some point or a higher level of trading was when I was able to see myself making those mistakes instead of justifying them or rationalizing them. Because you go through some crazy rationalization and silly thoughts as all the different modules in your brain kind of tell you different things and stuff. So I think that's one of the really fascinating things. I mean, it's true of bias in general, is that even when you know about bias, you tend to still be biased in that same direction. But in trading, it's fascinating that no matter how many years you've been doing it and how skilled you are, you still have a propensity to make the same stupid mistakes that a brand new trader will make. But I think the biggest difference is you identify those mistakes in real time and course correct. Or the alternative is you create systems that don't allow you to make those mistakes. So like for me, for example, if you're the kind of person where your stop was at 26, you said, okay, if it goes down to 26, I'm going to stop out. And then it goes to 26 and then you're looking at a chart and you're like, ooh, there's a support at 23. Maybe I'll move my stop to 22. And then it gets to 22 and you're like, oh, it looks bid here. Maybe I'll move my stop to 19. And I used to be that kind of person when I was in my 20s. And like a simple solution for that is you just put a stop loss in an automated system and you have like a speed bump. So like if I get stopped out, I can't do that trade again for 2 hours or whatever. So creating friction and rules to manage your bad behaviors, that's actually the best thing. Because like saying, okay, I'm going to have way better willpower than I had today. That's often a very big ask. So anyways, I just find it very interesting that this psychological challenges, they really never go away. And it doesn't matter how experienced you are. Or how new you are, it's just like this ongoing thing where your biggest enemy is always yourself. And no matter how good your trading methodology is and all that, a lot of people who are excellent traders blow up because they don't, you know, they're undisciplined or they rationalize some kind of deviation from risk management. And that reminiscence of a stock operator, for example. Yeah. He's literally saying like, I know I'm breaking my own rule, but I'm doing it anyway. And then he's bankrupt and he went bankrupt 3 times. And there's a lot of famous speculators that have fallen victim to that, who are probably among the greatest traders in the world.
Yeah. And so I would emphasize Alpha Trader. That's a bigger focus in that book for sure on these sides of trading, the mindset, as you say, but also all the other parts that are covered, but this specifically FX related, I guess, in the remainder of the book. You've also got some great book recos. We talked about one of those, but you've got that in the appendix as well. All right. Before I let you go, and if you have a few more minutes, Brent, I would love to just, you know, feel you out a little bit on some current things that are going on in the market. The market has heated up FX wise, certainly in the recent past here, because we've got this big break higher in the U.S. dollar. So I'd like your thought on that. The chief thing that's feeding that, obviously, I would argue to a degree, it's the Fed, to some degree, realizing it's making a policy mistake or having to adjust, or the market having to adjust to the idea that the Fed is going to have to move and move quicker than it previously thought was the case, when it seemed that the Fed was sort of lagging as many other more leading central banks. But what are your thoughts here on this market, starting with the dollar and as well with the recent reappointment of Powell and sort of Brainard? It was kind of odd. They're almost presented as co-chairs, it seemed like, the message that was sent from Biden's office, and some of the recent rhetoric we've seen on inflation from the Fed.
Sure. So I think you encapsulated pretty well, which is that the market had embraced the flexible average inflation targeting, which was the idea that the Fed would be lower for longer, which is kind of incredible in that they've often been criticized for staying too low for too long. And then they implemented a new framework, which was to stay even lower for even longer. And that was the dominant narrative until the June FOMC. And then at that FOMC, there's kind of hints of like, this maybe isn't like as hardcore dovish as we thought. And then really now the data has just completely run away from the Fed. So any idea that, you know, whatever definition you want to place on transitory. So if you were in the camp of this inflation will be transitory, at some point you have to stop out, right? So I wrote a piece about that one time that in life and in trading, one of the most difficult things to do is to stop out because switching costs are very high. So reputation wise, you know, if they finally go, okay, it's not transitory, and then they hike four times and it was transitory, they look stupid. So it's a very difficult challenge for the Fed. But now the data is just, I mean, the data is absolutely incredible in terms of the strength of, you know, Morgan Stanley just upgraded their Q4 GDP to 8.7%. You've got CPI running at 6%. I mean, this is the tightest job market that I've ever seen in my life. The initial claims lowest since 1969 came out. So it's just like an absolutely red hot economy, and they're pouring gasoline on it still, buying mortgage-backed securities, which is absolutely insane in my opinion. The politics changed a lot, and people, you know, on paper, the Fed's independent, but in reality, it's absolutely not. It's responding to the same stimuli that everyone else is. And it's a politically appointed position, as we saw the other day. And one really interesting tidbit from the announcement was Brainard's opening remarks. She mentioned inflation first before the job market. And So the view on Brainard was that she's dovish and that she's more about inclusion and climate change and some of like the Great Awakening type of messages and so that would lead to lower rates and less about inflation. But the reality is that there's just so much inflation now in the US that even if you're the most dovish person in the world, you just can't ignore that the inflation story has remained extremely, extremely vibrant and has become a big political and almost societal issue, you could say, at the margin. So that has led to a big pivot from the Fed, and the pivot just keeps on accelerating. So like now they're talking about accelerating the taper. And, you know, we could get to a point where the market's pricing in Fed hikes for March. Now, the challenge is, so this is like a classic monetary policy setup because the ECB's really pulling back on the reins, trying to just milk it for as long as possible because they've been below target on inflation for so long. So this on paper is a classic monetary policy trade. Now, the big challenge is that's why euro's at 112, right? So we've already moved a lot. We've gone from 122 in June to 112 now. And so I would think that the dollar higher trade makes a lot of sense, especially against emerging markets. But I'm not as convinced that we have a lot more to go higher in the dollar against G10 simply because we've already come a long way and market pricing has moved a lot. And now the expectations and just like the actual data have been so strong that I think it's very hard to now have like a step change of stronger data, but you could have a step change of slightly weaker data as the COVID cases pick up in the US, which is certainly happening, and in Europe. And then you have a little bit of a fiscal cliff coming as well. So it's kind of like a non-view that I'm giving here, which is that the dollar rally makes a lot of sense to me, but I'm not sure I'd be piling in now after, you know, almost a 10% move.
No, I fully understand where you're coming from. And I agree with you. And I think there's aggravating factors. I think people appreciate how weak the euro is right now. There's a creeping fair value level that's been creeping higher over time. You know, so yesterday's one, 115 in euro is in a different place now. And there's also this complicating factor of Europe of just, you know, the COVID, like you said, COVID being the center of the center of the COVID outbreak now is Europe. And this is a very special situation with natural gas and power as a complicating factor too. I mean, just sentiment is getting about as bad as it can get pretty soon, I would argue, with the euro, not that it can't go a bit lower. I just wonder, and so how the Fed executes this policy turnaround, and especially how they do so when it seemed a lot of the equity market upside, and I guess you can agree with me that the equity market has been something very remarkable since the pandemic outbreak lows, that there's not some kind of nominal equity market targeting as part of their policy as well. That almost feels like that's the third mandate, or it seems like it's common knowledge that that is the third mandate of the Fed. But I think, or would you agree with that? Or would you think that inflation at these levels requires the Fed has to place that at the very top of their priority list now, especially as Biden clearly has a stronger political signaling he's doing right now that this inflation problem is serious business?
Yeah. See, I would say that so what you're referring to is the Fed put, which started with Greenspan. And that's the idea that essentially when stocks fall 20% or more, the Fed cuts. I would say that the Fed put is probably lower now because the starting conditions in this cycle are just so crazy different from the other cycles. They had the luxury of cutting rates the second that the stock market fell in the past because inflation was generally pretty low and anchored. And now it's high and it's a little bit unanchored. So I don't think the Fed put is as close as people think, or as close as it was in the past. And another interesting thing, which I think is very underappreciated, is that this could be very negative for crypto because one of the fundamental underlying reasons for crypto as a not I'm not talking about Web3 and L2 and all that stuff, but I'm talking about Bitcoin, especially as a store of value, is that the Fed is relentlessly printing dollars and will never hike rates. Now, if we enter a regime where they do start hiking and in a meaningful way, and you see other risky assets like stocks start to sell off, I think crypto will be very vulnerable. I think people are making the same mistake. I'm not saying this is like 1999 in terms of bubblicious, but I think people are making the same mistake that they made in 1999, which is the story is good and it's a structural story and I like it at any price. And the reality is that it's an amazing structural story and I'm bullish on crypto as an asset class and I'm bullish on Web3. But there's going to be extreme cycles within that because the amount of money being deployed and the amount of froth and hype, the hype cycle is so aggressive this time, that you could see, you know, 60-70% corrections in a lot of this stuff. And that wouldn't disrupt the bull case, just like the crypto winter in 2017 didn't disrupt the bull case. So I think people are not putting two and two together, even though they were very happy to do that when the Fed eased and use that as a reason to buy crypto. People aren't putting two and two together and saying, oh, I should probably lighten up here, given that the Fed dollar debasement story clearly is not a thing. If you look at what the dollar's doing, it's ripping. It's not being debased in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah. And by the way, I should mention, you also send out, crypto is not just something you dabble in lightly. You've actually have a newsletter you've been sending out on crypto as well. Do you want to mention anything about that?
Sure. So anything that people want to see or sign up for is at spectramarkets.com. And so, yeah, you can sign up for the crypto thing is free. I just send it out when I have a strong view. And what my lane is, because like I'm a TradFi guy, a traditional finance guy. My lane is whenever there's kind of an intersection between behavioral or macroeconomics and crypto, then I'll write about it. But I'm not the guy that's going to be talking about, you know, whether Avalanche is going to beat Solana and all that kind of stuff. I watch it from the sidelines and eat my popcorn. But what anything I'm writing about is more in kind of like my traditional lane, which is fiat currencies and what's driving them. And, you know, there's a lot of overlap with crypto. Crypto's obviously has currency in the name, but some of them behave like risky asset currencies. Like very often you'll see a relationship between the Australian dollar and Bitcoin will tend to move together because they're both risky assets that benefit from a weak dollar and struggle when the dollar's strong. So so people can sign up for that. It's free. And then my daily is called AMFX, and that's a paid, it's $490 a year.
Great. And actually, I think we could probably just close it out there. Brent Donnelly of SpectrumMarkets.com. Of course, I'll provide the link to SpectrumMarkets.com in the podcast show links. You're real a great voice out there on FX. I think an asset class that at times goes quiet and at times gets very, very intensely interesting. It feels like it's getting tilting a little bit more towards the latter recently. There's a lot of moving parts. I think they're very interesting right now in the G10 FX space even, and not just in emerging markets. So thank you, Brent, so much for coming on the show for this special edition. And yeah, until hopefully there will be a next time. If in any case, until next time, Brent.
Awesome. Thanks, John. Thanks a lot for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter at Saxo Market Call or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.